This is the fourth in the series on the oral law called Does Halacha Change? Okay, the topic for tonight is Does Halacha, Jewish law, change? Actually, the answer to that question is trivial. Of course it changes. First of all, as I've described earlier in this series, the rabbis create new laws, have created many, many new laws, and that's a change in the body of law, by addition. Secondly, the rabbis can add laws which make received laws, prior laws, inoperable, as we described the case of Rosh Hashanah coming out on Shabbos. We don't blow the shofar because the rabbi said not to blow it. So they can even make a law which forestalls the performance of an earlier law, even a biblical law. So does Jewish law change? Of course it changes. On the other hand, when you see that at a particular time, Jews as individuals or the community behaved in one way, and at a later time they behaved in another way, one should not infer that there was a change of law. It could be that some of the laws have trigger conditions. The law says when ABC is the case, do Q. When ABC is not the case, don't do Q. Do R. Now, the historian or the sociologist noticed that in one generation they're doing P, the next generation they're doing R. And because he's ignorant of the legal basis, assumes that the change of behavior was due to a change in law. But that need not be the case. This is a very common mistake, because the people who chart the history of these matters are often grossly ignorant of Jewish law. Now, so the question is not, does Jewish law change? The question is, how does it change? Under what conditions does it change? What are the rules of change? What are the limits of change? And I want to discuss two particular problems tonight. One is when there's a rabbinic law that was designed to serve a purpose and no longer serves the purpose. Does the law automatically lapse? Can it change? Should it change? That's one question. And the other question is, when conditions change, to what extent does that license changing even the laws that go back to Moses? Those are two different issues, both of which are widely controversial and therefore deserve our attention. I'll start with the rabbinic laws that are designed to serve a purpose. Imagine that 2,200 years ago, the Sanhedrin makes a law, do A in order to accomplish B. And at that time, doing A really did promote B. But as circumstances changed, 500 years later, 1,000 years later, doing A no longer promotes B. It's not connected to B. Circumstances have changed to the point where A and B aren't related anymore. What happens to the law of doing A? Most often, the law doesn't change and the practice doesn't change. And those two are not the same, as you'll see. I'll distinguish them in about 5 minutes. Most often it does not change. And here the critic asks, why not? If the law was designed to serve a purpose and it no longer serves that purpose, why shouldn't it spontaneously lapse since it's not serving its purpose? Or why doesn't somebody do something about it? The first thing I want to point out to you is that this question would not arise in any legal system. It's, I think, at best peculiar. It's a certain lack of critical reflection in asking the question, because you wouldn't ask this question about any man-made, supposedly logical, functional, pragmatic legal system, and yet it's asked over here. Let me illustrate. In 1973, there was a Mideast war. And the Arab nations declared an oil boycott on the United States. And there was a tremendous shortage of oil, and therefore a shortage of gasoline. There was gasoline rationing. If you had an even license number, you could only get gas on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. If you could had an odd number, you could only get it on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. The price of gasoline was gigantic. And the United States of America instituted a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit for the whole nation. Now, what I've told you so far is true. Now, let's imagine that it plays itself out as follows. It didn't happen this way, but imagine that the speed limit is instituted in November because of the shortage of gas. But in May, the Arabs revoked their embargo. By June, the oil is being delivered to the refineries. And by July, it's at the pumps. And by August, the price of gas is going down to normal prices. So, our friend George fills up his tank at the local gas station, goes out on the highway, and he's doing 75. A state trooper pulls him over and he says, "Don't you know there's a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit?" And he says, "Of course I know that, officer, but don't you read the papers? The whole purpose of the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit was to save gas because of the Arab oil embargo. And the embargo's over, and there's plenty of gas, and it's regular price. So there's no reason for that law anymore. So surely I can drive as I please." Do you think he'll win in court or lose in court? I think he's going to lose, right? Should he lose? Is this just fascist America, you know, where they beat people up with respect to irrelevant laws? Of course not. Because to change a law, the same body that passed it has to revoke it. If a legislature passes a law, the law is enforced until that legislature revokes it. And as I'm sure you're all aware, in August, there's no legislature in the United States. Our legislators are climbing the China Wall, or they're scuba diving in Eilat, or they're vacationing in Alaska. They won't be back together till November again. You can't change a law in America in August. So they'll just have to wait. It's clear it doesn't serve its purpose. So what? Failing to serve the purpose has nothing to do with the legal validity of the law. And as a matter of fact, the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit was maintained in the United States for 20 years. 19 years after the oil embargo was released, and oil was plentiful, gas was plentiful, they kept it for another 19 years. So that even though it didn't continue to serve the original purpose for its creation, the legislature chose to keep it in place. And if you think about it, it's pretty obvious that when you pass a law for one purpose, that law may serve other purposes as well. And you may come to discover through experiencing the operation of the law that it's good for other reasons. And therefore, the fact that it fails to serve its original purpose doesn't mean that it's automatically invalid or irrelevant or non-pragmatic. Someone has to make that determination. And that's the legislature that passed it in the first place. So the idea that a law no longer serves the purpose for which it was created and therefore should automatically, spontaneously lapse, and then we face the critic who says, "And all these laws don't serve their original purposes, so why are you maintaining them? You must be some kind of, you know, fundamentalist, superstitious culture which can't criticize the past," or on and on with the standard anthropological, sociological critique, when the question wouldn't be asked of any other legal system. That's point number one. But the follow-up point will usually, the follow-up critic will usually be this. Okay, in the United States case, you have to wait from August until November until our legislatures come back to Washington and get back to work. And then they can make a determination. We've been waiting about 1,600 years. That's a long time to wait. You know, since the Sanhedrin no longer functioned about 1,600 years ago, we haven't had a Sanhedrin. Don't you think that, okay, wait a year, wait a decade, a century? How about a millennium? After a millennium, don't you think it's time to reconsider? Don't you think it's time to do something about it? Here, I think the question from the point of view of a man-made pragmatic legal system would be correct. At a certain point, if it no longer served a purpose and people couldn't see that it served any other purpose, presumably something should be done about that. But if the question is being asked of us, from our point of view, the critique is still not valid. I'll tell you why. Because the same God who made the legal rule that a law passed by the Sanhedrin has to be revoked by the Sanhedrin, I can't be revoked by anyone else, which rule is in common to every legal society. The same God who made that rule is also running history. The fact that we lack the Sanhedrin is not an accident. It's not really the result of the Roman persecutions. It is something which divine providence arranged should happen. And therefore, the same God who said you need a Sanhedrin to revoke the law said, I'm taking away the Sanhedrin. Now, if you can add 2 and 2 and get 4, the result ought to be God is telling us, I don't want you to change it. I don't want you to have that authority. It's sort of like the government issues driver's licenses, and if someone commits a certain type of offense on the road, they take it away and they say, we don't want you to drive anymore. We gave you the license, we're taking away the license. So once you understand that history is a matter of divine providence, then the fact that we don't consider the law to lapse automatically, or we don't take it into our own hands to change the law, should be pretty obvious. Here, the divide between us and the critic is that fundamental assumption that history is or is not controlled by divine providence. I say it's an assumption. For us, it's not just an assumption. We have reason for it. I'm not fighting that battle tonight. Let's say it's an assumption. He assumes that there's no divine providence, and we assume that there is divine providence. That means that from our point of view, in articulating our position, I don't see any critique. He's just coming from an external point of view and saying, if I were running it, since I don't believe in God and I don't believe in divine providence, I certainly would have done something about it. And we could say, we agree with you. For a person who doesn't believe in God, your position is perfectly reasonable. But you ought to be able to appreciate that for we who do believe in God, our position is reasonable for us. That divine providence has deprived us of the tool which God himself said is the only way to change the law. And he's sending us a clear signal, I don't want you to change the law. Having said all of this, the norm we should expect is, if I have a law A, which was created to serve purpose B, and in the course of time, it no longer serves that purpose, and now the Sanhedrin no longer exists, then of course the law will remain in effect. And that's true for most cases, but it isn't true for some. Here the surprise is that some of the things that used to be done on the basis of the leadership of Sanhedrin do lapse with time. Notice I changed my vocabulary. Now I said things. Some of the things that used to be done do lapse with time. And now we ought to ask the opposite question. Why should they lapse at all? Why should anything ever lapse? I'll give you 2 examples, so we'll have something concrete in mind, and then I'll explain to you what the idea is behind it. And when I finish this, I'll stop for questions for a while before I go on to the next subject. There is a law not to ride horses on Shabbos. The reason that's given is because, in those days at least, it was typical for people who rode horses to pull down a branch from a tree and use it to hit the horse with. Pulling down the branch from a tree would violate the biblical law going back to Moses. And lest a person climb on the horse and forget that it's Shabbos and pull down a branch, they said, don't ride horses. Now, today, if you go horseback riding, you have a switch made by Christian Dior with top style. And, you go out with, everybody gets out with their digital cameras, take it up and put it up on your website. You're certainly not pulling down branches from trees. Doesn't matter. You still can't ride horses on Shabbos. That has not changed. On the other hand, the Talmud says, if you have a liquid that was left uncovered and unattended, certain liquids, you should not drink them. Why should you not drink them? Because, at least in their times, poisonous reptiles were common in human habitations. There was the possibility that a reptile, when it was uncovered and unattended, drank from it and left behind traces of poison, and it could be dangerous. That's what it says in the Talmud. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, 500 years ago, writes that in our times it is permissible to drink uncovered and unattended liquids. Why? Because we don't have any snakes and scorpions in our habitations. So there, it really did change. And the question now, given the background that I've described to you, is Why should it change? Why should it ever change? And here's the answer. The answer is in exactly how the law was formulated and how the application to the particular case was made. I'll describe it to you abstractly, and then I'll put it into the two cases, and I hope that'll make it clear. You can have a case where the law is do A. That's the law. The law says do A. Now, in the book of laws, there are footnotes at the back, you know, starting from page 1206. And you look at the footnote that says, at the time when the law A was instituted, it was instituted for the purpose of accomplishing B or promoting B. But that's a footnote at the back of the book. The content of the law is do A. Under those conditions, nothing changes. Nothing changes. But suppose, to the contrary, that the law is promote B. B is the law. Promote B. And then at the back of the book in the footnotes you have, at the times of the Talmud, doing A promoted B, and therefore the Talmudic sages said, in order to fulfill the law of promoting B, do A. Here B is the law, what we called the purpose before. And A is related to B, and therefore in pursuing the performance of B, we are told to do A. If then, 1,500 years later, A no longer promotes B, there's no reason to do A. There never was a law to do A. The law was to promote B. If A doesn't promote B, there's no reason to do it. In this case, practice will change. That's why I switched to the word thing. Practice will change. The law never changes. In neither case does the law change. Your practice changes. Your practice changes because in the second type of case, where the law is promote B, and you only did A because it promoted B, if A doesn't promote B anymore, there's no reason to do A. Whereas in the first case, if the law is do A, and B was just the reason they legislated A, but what they legislated was to do A, then you can never stop doing A. Now, that's what happened in these two cases. Let me apply it to the cases. In the case of the horses on Shabbos, the law was don't ride horses. At page 1206, it says, the reason they instituted that law was because at that time, when people rode horses, they pulled down branches from trees. But the law had nothing to do with pulling down branches from trees. The law was don't ride horses. Now nobody pulls down branches from trees, doesn't matter. To revoke that law, you need a Sanhedrin on a par with the Sanhedrin that passed it. But in the second case, the law is protect your health. That's the law. The legal responsibility is to protect your health. Then there was an observation. In the times of the Talmud, if you are going to be careful about protecting your health, you'd better not drink uncovered and unattended liquids because there was a risk to your health. So 1,500 years later, or 1,000 years later, when the Shulchan Aruch was written, he said, look, we abide by exact same law of the Talmud, protect your health. But uncovered and unattended liquids aren't dangerous anymore. And therefore, there's no reason to refrain from drinking them. So in both cases, the law is preserved without change. But in the second case, practice will change because the practice of refraining from uncovered and unattended liquids was only instituted because it contributed to the law of protecting oneself. And nowadays, it doesn't protect oneself anymore. Yeah. Well, hold on a second. If I'm understanding you correctly, yes. Everything I just said answered your question.
Yes, but I'm having a problem with that. Okay, what part of it answered? Because the law, I understand, the law isn't eat like poultry and dairy. The law is keep kosher. And then, in the footnotes,
No. The law that was passed was don't eat dairy with poultry. That was the law that was made. The reason for the law was not that people will confuse it, seeing it, but more that people will not appreciate that this is a reasonable category and will be lightheaded about it. In other words, they'll say, listen, turkey tastes a lot like veal, and if one's permissible, the other's got to be permissible. It can't really be that different. Not a question that you can't tell by looking, but you won't appreciate that there's a real significant difference there. But whatever the point is, in that case, the law was don't eat poultry with dairy. No, the reason it wasn't revoked is because we don't have a Sanhedrin.
Okay, so we're not allowed to revoke any laws, no matter how irrelevant they can get.
That's right, because if the law was do X and was passed by a Sanhedrin, the only way you can revoke that law is by another Sanhedrin. We don't have a Sanhedrin.
Well, kid, I'm just curious. Can you, other than the poison one, which other ones were revoked? Like, what other ones were revoked?
Well, there is, it's very interesting that in the Talmudic discussions, the laws don't come labeled. Was this law do A because B, or was the law promote B and A was an observation? They don't come labeled that way. You have to infer from the way the law is discussed in the Talmud which type of law it was. And there is one about which there's some controversy. And that is, for example, taking medicines on Shabbos. The original prohibition against taking medicines when you're not, when your life isn't in danger or a limb isn't in danger, talking about for a headache or a toothache. The original reason for not taking medicines was because medicines were stored in solid form, and when you wanted to use them, you ground them up into a powder. Grinding into a powder is forbidden on Shabbos by Mosaic law. Now, there is a dispute. Was it that the law said don't take medicines? And the footnote in the back said, because we're worried about grinding. Or was the law be very careful about grinding? And then the observation was, taking medicines could lead you to grind, and therefore you shouldn't take medicines. And therefore, there is a difference of opinion in contemporary Jewish law, how strict you have to be about taking medicines on Shabbos. There are some who are very strict, and some are more lenient. And one element in the discussion is, what kind of law was it originally? If originally was a law not to take medicines, then nothing could change that, and nothing can make it more lenient. If the original law was protect against grinding, and today nobody grinds when they take medicines, so then you can be much more lenient. So that's another example. Yeah, that's really not a law. That's considered by the Talmud something more serious than law, and that is an observation about health. And there, the rule is it's an application of the law of guarding your health.
It's still seen as a health reason.
It is, although I don't know of any observations that have been made to that have revealed what the health problem is. But if you know a little bit of the history of medicine, you could be a little cautious about drawing conclusions on the basis of non-observations. I could tell you some terrible stories. Yeah.
Two questions. So with medicine, how far would one, even if one held that you're not allowed to because the Sanhedrin ushered taking medicine altogether, how far can one take that? Like, would liquid gels also be?
Okay, at this point, I'm out of my competence. My job is the philosophical principles. To talk about practical law and the nitty-gritty, the details, I'm just not competent to do that.
Okay, so then the second question was...
Okay, yeah. It's pretty soon I'm going to have to start the second topic. Yeah, go ahead.
Stick with me. I have three questions. My first question is, we know we can't change the Sanhedrin's law. That's out of our league, but... Don't we have the freedom to interpret the laws? As in, can't we say, hey, for let's say in the case of the horse, like, who says that they made the horse laws, like, for the means? Like, can't we say they did it so we won't pull the branches on Shabbos, so nowadays we can do it because we're not contradicting what they said, we're just reinterpreting what they said?
Well, reinterpreting.
Or interpreting.
Interpreting. There has to be some fidelity to the original meaning when you're interpreting. They said, don't do X. Let's interpret that to mean, on the first day of the year, don't do X. And then we can do it all the other 364 days. We're interpreting it, right? And then, you can lose it one day a year, the rest of the days. That's not interpreting, right? That's a joke. If you're subject to the postmodernist critique and deconstructionism, we need a half hour together. I can try to persuade you to become more realistic about life. That stuff is utterly, utterly frivolous intellectually. It's frivolous. So I don't think you can sensibly say that if the law was don't ride horses, you read into it the opposite law that we're only protecting trees, and therefore we have the words that they said, we have the way it was practiced for more than 2,000 years, and interpretation is not going to get you very far. Of course we have the right to interpret, we have the responsibility to interpret. That's quite true. Yeah.
What about laws that were passed later, after the time of the Sanhedrin? How do the rules there?
Okay, I'll just answer this, and then I've got to go on to the next topic, and then we can discuss at the end. It's very interesting. There is a verse in the Torah which says, with respect to the Sanhedrin, When they tell you something, you're not allowed to turn aside from what they say to you, right or left. Very, very strict. Many take that verse to apply not only to the Sanhedrin, but when there's no Sanhedrin, it can apply to a law that is the consensus of Jewish opinion. A consensus. Such things do happen. I know it sounds fantastic that a whole body of rabbis would all agree on one subject, on one idea, but it does happen. And when that happens, it could have an authority similar to that of the Sanhedrin. At least that verse is applied. I'll give you an example. Chayyadim writes this in his introduction to the laws of Pesach. In many communities in Europe, there was a law, a custom that was decided upon and agreed upon by all the rabbinic authorities that at the Seder, you should use white wine, not red wine. Even though, according to the normal legal sources, red wine is preferable, can you guess why they used white wine? Because of blood libels, right? You don't want the non-Jews bursting in and saying it's all blood and slaughtering the inhabitants. So they said to use white wine. And he writes there, if someone will violate that, it will be like violating a law of the Sanhedrin because everyone agreed to it. No one disagreed to it. Same thing with us poor Ashkenazim who can't eat rice on Pesach because rice was processed together with grains and it was very difficult to get pure rice. You know, if you're really worried about that, become a Sephardi, which you can do. And that way you'll be able to eat rice on Pesach, but we can't do that because it was really a universally agreed upon stringency. And therefore, it'll be binding. That can happen, but that could be overturned by another consensus at a later time because it was instituted by a consensus. Okay, I know there are more questions here, but let me get to the second topic, which in some circles is even more controversial, and it needs to be understood carefully. Maybe 20 years ago, I was ill here in this country, and I was listening to a talk show on the radio. A woman called in and said, the rabbis in Israel are not doing their job. So the host said, why is that? And she said, because according to the laws, the religious laws, we can't take buses to the beach on Saturdays. And we need to go to the beach, and we want to go to the beach. So the rabbis should figure out how we can do that. They're not doing their job. Okay, job description for a rabbi. Figure out how I can do what I want to do. But it wasn't just this woman who was calling up at the talk show. There are movements in the United States who operate under the following slogan, among other slogans, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. If the rabbis really want to make it happen, they can always figure out a way to make it happen. The system is really infinitely flexible. You've heard of this, huh? It's infinitely flexible. There are no strict principles. And if it doesn't happen, it's only because those rabbis, those nasty, prejudiced, power-hungry rabbis, don't want it to happen, and they prevent people from having the freedom that they would desire. Let's look at the case that they offer as the paradigm case proving that there are no limits on what can be done if the rabbis want. I'll give you their analysis, and then I'll give you the correct analysis, and then we'll be able to formulate the rules under which changes of this type can take place. There is a biblical law that at the end of every 7 years, personal debts are canceled. Somebody borrows money from you as a personal loan. 7 years go, well, to the end of the seventh year, we're in the seventh year. At the end of this year, Rosh Hashanah, we're coming to Rosh Hashanah, you haven't collected your money, the money's lost. It's canceled. That's what the biblical law says. Well, you don't expect the rabbis to take that sitting down, do you? That's too inconvenient. That's going to stymie all sorts of industry, and we're going to invest in somebody's livelihood and so on and so on. So what did the rabbis do? They created a document. And this document says that the loan is transferred to the court, so it isn't really your personal loan. And then when you collect it in the name of the court, and then you keep the money. And in that way, you can collect money that was borrowed from you 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Just at each time, when you come to the end of the seventh year, you get a document and in every synagogue in the world, they hand out these documents, and then you get two friends to sign it. And with that document, you can collect all the debts that would have been canceled by the biblical law. So, this group says, clearly, this is just a joke. This is what's called a legal fiction. You obviously made it up, and you made it up because it's very inconvenient to have loans canceled at the end of the seventh year. And if you can do it for this, a biblical law, you can get around the biblical law with a phony instrument like that. Clearly, if you have enough ingenuity, you can get around any law you want. Well, as a matter of fact, this instrument called the Prusbul, which was invented by Hillel, is discussed in the Gemara in several places. It's discussed in the Mishnais, in Shviz, and the Gemara and the commentaries explain exactly what the principles are behind the document. And I will explain them to you, and then I think you'll see that the picture of infinite flexibility and that it's all subject to the rabbi's whim isn't exactly correct. But first of all, let me just point out that Hillel lived about 1,300 years after the Torah was given. And if a cancellation law, canceling all loans at the end of every 7 years, is very inconvenient for a community, one ought to wonder what happened for 1,300 years. They didn't perceive that it was inconvenient. Nobody noticed it. Somehow they lived without the problem, and they managed to overcome the problem. Later it became too difficult to overcome. I mean, how does one explain that it took 1,300 years to think it up? Hillel was smarter than everybody else that came 1,300 years before. I mean, something funny is going on here in historical terms. But let's leave that aside. The Talmud describes the situation as follows. This law that cancels loans, it's true that it's written in the Torah. At the end of the seventh year, the loans are no longer collectible. But the majority of authorities hold that that law doesn't apply in our times. It hasn't applied from the time that the majority of Jews no longer lived in the land of Israel, which goes back to the Babylonian exile, actually. Because it's tied to the agricultural laws, indeed it's written in the same paragraph in the Torah, and the agricultural laws also biblically lapsed when the majority of Jews are not living in the land of Israel. So, biblically speaking, there is no such cancellation law. But the rabbis enacted imitative legislation. The rabbis said, we don't want the biblical law to be forgotten, and therefore we want you to cancel your loans. The whole reason in our times and in Hillel's times to cancel loans at the end of the seventh year is rabbinic, not biblical. Well, now, if the rabbis write a law, they own it, and they can write it as they please. And if they choose to write an escape clause into their own law, there's nothing invalid about that. That's not a legal fiction. That's not circumventing a law. They created it, and they created the escape clause. So what they said was this. Every loan is canceled rabbinically at the end of the seventh years, unless you fill out our document, in which case, we don't apply our cancellation to your case. You may ask, why would they do that? Why would they create a law and then create an easy way to circumvent their own law? First of all, it's done many times. I can give you a dozen examples if you like. And the reason, one reason anyway, on the surface is, this way you will jolly well remember that the end of the seventh year is important for your loans. Because the end of the seventh year, every end of the seventh year, you'll have to make out that document. So by creating the cancellation and giving you a way to circumvent it, the idea of the cancellation becomes rooted in the Jewish consciousness, not just as a historical fact of thousands of years ago, and that's certainly accomplished by it. According to that position, there's no legal fiction, there's no circumvention, all the laws are perfectly well upheld, and there's no difficulty. Let's talk about the minority. Let me finish the picture, and then I'll take your question. What about the minority who say that the biblical cancellation law is still in force? Okay, so at the end of every 7 years, the biblical law says the loan is canceled and it's no longer collectible. But as a matter of fact, the Jewish court has the authority to tax and to redistribute property as it pleases. Hefker bezdin hefker, which is learned from various verses, having nothing to do in particular with this case, as used very widely. Monetary matters are completely under the control of the court. So, according to this opinion that the Torah canceled the debt, the rabbi said, indeed, it is canceled, but we make an award of the debtor's property to the lender in amount of the original loan. Yeah, we can do that because we can transfer property at will. So here too, the authority to do it is based on a long-standing, independently established legal rule that they have the ability to redistribute property at will. That's one feature. The feature is, where does the authority come to institute this document called the prosbul? Either it's because the cancellation law in our times is rabbinic, they own the law, they can write it as they please, or it's biblical, but they can redistribute property as they please. But that's not enough. It's not enough to have the authority to make the change. You also have to have motivation to make the change. And the motivation has to be internal to the legal system or to the Torah's system of values. And in this case, the Torah itself describes a motivation. It's written in Moses' book. It says in the Torah, you have to cancel the loans at the end of 7 years. And if there'll be a thought in your heart, a perverse, wicked thought in your heart, the end of the seventh year is coming. It's coming to the end. My poor friend here's house burned down, and he's asking for a loan. The end of the seventh year is 3 months from now. Will he have enough money to pay me before the end of the seventh year? Or am I going to lose my money if I lend it to him? I don't want to lend it to him. I don't want to take that chance. Let him live on the street for 3 months. When it's over, then I'll lend it to him. You know, I have 7 years to collect. If that Blial is the word that the Torah uses, that vicious, wicked, corrupt thought occurs to your mind, and then the Torah calls down curses on such a person. So the Torah itself already envisioned the following mental set. The Torah says, cancel the laws at the end of the seventh year. The Torah also says, lend money to people in need. That's one of the 613 commandments. It's a positive commandment in Kesef Tal Vesami. You are required to lend money to a person who's in need. And now you will have people who say, we're not doing both. We're not doing both. You're going to cancel the loans, we're not going to lend. Not till the cancellation date is over. In other words, these people are waving a flag and saying, we're not doing everything the Torah told us to do. We're just not doing it. So now the rabbis say, either way, a mitzvah is going to be lost. Either way, a mitzvah is going to be lost. If the cancellation is in place, they won't lend. So now, since these people, by their vicious motivation, have created for them a conflict between two laws, there's a motivation, a legal motivation, to do something about it. Now you can take into account the fact that if they don't lend, the poor are going to suffer. And then you say, well, since either way, not both laws are going to be satisfied, we choose to satisfy the lending law and to circumvent the canceling law by our power to redistribute property as we please, because in that way we can service the poor. But it's not, as is sometimes painted, bleeding heart liberal sentiments against the law, and when nobody's looking, you sort of monkey with the law so you can satisfy your bleeding heart liberal sentiments. That's not what's going on. Indeed, to paint liberal sentiments as external to the law is to misunderstand the law. The law is more sensitive, more sympathetic, more caring than anyone's mere political intuitions. But at any rate, these are the conditions under which changes can be made. Two conditions have to be met. There has to be authority to make the change, and there has to be an internal legal motivation to make the change. If either one of those is missing, then the system will not change. It is certainly not a case of where there's a rabbinic will, there's a legal way or a halachic way. You cannot play with the system infinitely. If a critic from the outside wishes to implement fundamentally non-Jewish values and wants the Torah laws to change, he'd be lacking the legal motivation. And then the fact that it won't change is because you have a different set of values. If the value is one which the Torah subscribes to, and it still doesn't change, that's because we're lacking the legal authority to do so. And then we go back to what we said in the first half. We're lacking legal authority because God deprived us of those institutions, and therefore he doesn't want us to have the power to be able to make those changes. Okay, question. You had a question.
Yeah, if the lend money to a poor person like 3 months before the Shemitah year. Then he gets the loan, he builds his house, but then the house goes right back to the guy because the bank is going to give the lender back his money.
That's only a question of when the payment date is set, and the conditions of payment are set, right?
Well, it doesn't go back like at the end of the 7th year.
Well, the date of payment has lapsed. The date of payment has lapsed, right? The rabbis are making a new award. They're making a new award, right? That legally, it's a new award. Now, being a new award, then it may have new conditions. Yeah. Well, okay, could be. Yeah.
Well, the rabbis, why wouldn't they just say that like you have to give someone a loan? Seems like that would be like, it's a commandment by Hashem, like you have like a choice saying, okay, I'm not going to follow a commandment by Hashem. If it says you have to give your brother a loan, you say like, oh, I'm not going to give him a loan? Like, isn't that just not following a mitzvah?
Well, it's true, and you're right that in general, a person who waves the flag and says, I'm not doing this mitzvah, will be compelled to do the mitzvah. But here it depends a lot on what your resources are. You don't have to bankrupt yourself, and it's a question of how genuine his need is. And there are people who in some cases at least, pretend to be needy. For example, a person's house burns down. It may be that he's already collected enough money for that house 3 times on the grounds that his house burned down. And you're number 4. Right? And you don't know that. So in order to establish the real bona fides that this is taking place...
Would that person be the wrong man?
Of course he would, but if you'll become a lawyer, you'll deal with lots of people who are in the wrong. The point of the laws is to administer society when people are going to do the wrong thing. If everybody did the right thing, we wouldn't need so many laws. Yeah. So this is a good example. There is a statement in the Talmud at the end of a meal. If you have had salty foods, which was typically, especially if it was meat, it was always salted, then you should wash your hands at the end. I am not hurting, last waters. The Talmud says because there's a certain type of salt that is very, very powerful, and should it get into your eyes, it could injure your eyesight. Therefore, you should. So now, in the Shulchan Aruch, you have the following. In the beginning of the section, it says, Mayim Acharonim Chova. It is an obligation to wash the last waters. At the end, he says, that was true in the Talmudic times when they had that very powerful salt. We don't have that very powerful salt. So in our times, it's not necessary. That's what he writes. The Gaon of Vilna says, I say it's still necessary because there are other reasons, which they didn't tell you. And when the Gaon of Vilna said it, usually meant Kabbalistic reasons because he was a master of the Kabbalah. And he doesn't go into details what they are, as he usually, you know, leaves that for a person who's capable of independent scholarship. So now you have, the Shulchan Aruch says you don't have to because on the basis of the legal system, the reason has lapsed. And in that particular case, there was no law to wash. The law was, be careful about the salt. And that's right, so we don't have it. So today, there are some people who do and some people who don't. Yeah.
I still don't understand the subtlety between when a law is made for that law and the reason is just like a footnote in the back. First off, I mean, if we know it's still made for the footnote in the back, what difference does it make if it's a footnote in the back or, like, you know, in the main clause? We know it's for that reason. If that reason isn't applying, well, why can't we change it?
Why can't we change it? Is that your question?
No, why do we still have to do it if that law doesn't apply?
So now, let's be careful now. You said 2 different things. We've got to be careful that we don't get confused. Why can't you change it is answered by?
You can't change it.
Right. You don't have the right legal body to change it. I'm emphasizing because you're the third person who's asked this after I said it. So I want to make sure that we're not losing it. Right? Why can't you change it? Because you aren't the right you. You don't have the right identity to change it. That's right. Now, why doesn't it lapse spontaneously? Because the original legislature that passed it hasn't revoked it. Laws don't go to pieces spontaneously. Think of the case of the 55-mile-hour speed limit. The fact that its original purpose lapsed did not give it, rob it of its validity. It remained in place until the legislature changed it.
Yeah, but we know the legislator passed it for that reason.
The same was true of the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. We know what the reason was. The reason was the oil embargo.
But for example, like in the same example of the oil embargo, you can only get your gas on like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Like we don't still get our gas on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, like once a week, whatever it was, because we changed that.
Correct, and yet the law didn't lapse. The law didn't lapse for 20 years. Nobody said after a year, we all have gas now, so we don't have to abide by the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. Nobody said that. Had he said that, he'd be in jail. Because the legislature that passed it didn't revoke it. The fact that a law doesn't serve its original reason does not mean that the law is not valid anymore.
And also then why would if they pass the law for the sake of an end, like let's say that Shabbos with the horseback riding, mm-hmm. why would they ever make that law just like why wouldn't they always just say this law is for the sake of that end?
That's an interesting question. Why not formulate all the laws so that they will spontaneously change when the reason is no longer applicable? Imagine a case like this. George is driving in a residential area at 3 a.m. Of course, everything's deserted, right? It's not Los Angeles, right? It's a civilized place. People are all asleep at 3 a.m. And he runs a stop sign. And a police trooper comes out from behind the bushes, pulls him over and gives him a ticket. And he says, "Officer, clearly the stop sign is designed to protect property and protect life. And I understand that at 9 a.m. and at noon and at 3 p.m. there are people in their vehicles on the road and one has to be very careful. But it was 3 a.m. Nobody was there. Surely the stop sign wasn't designed for 3 a.m. Now, carefully, in logic, is George right or wrong? No, I think he's right. He's right. The stop sign with, I understand now in America, in some places, they have stop signs with lights, with electric lights, and they tell you stop sign is not valid at certain times and only valid at other times. Just that we didn't have that facility before. It's very expensive. But everybody understands stop sign is not made for when the streets are deserted. But if you allow a person to say it wasn't made for now, you're going to make the law subject to every person's judgment. You can't have that. You can't have a law subject to every person's judgment. I don't think, there was only one kid and he was half a block away. And I'm driving over here. He couldn't get here in time for me to drive across over him. So clearly it wasn't dangerous, right? He was a quarter of a block away, but I'm very careful. I watch him, I watch him the whole time. So I wouldn't drive over him. You can't make laws subject to the judgment of people. Laws have to be square at the edges. They have to be objective. They have to be, you have to be able to tell when they apply, when they don't apply, with simple objective features. So if you're going to make every law based on the purpose, you're opening it up to anarchy, to chaos, where everyone will say, in my case, the purpose didn't apply, or my community were smarter, so we would make that mistake, and it'll be impossible. That's why the ones that can spontaneously change in practice are very, very rare. Yeah.
Still on the books, and it is still enforced. There are many laws that remain on the books and do not change in time, but with societal changes, the enforcement no longer exists, although the law stays on the books. How does that apply to the
case? That's a very interesting observation. It is quite true that there's a little bit of, I would say, pressure from the bottom against the top, Okay, we know you passed the law, but we also know it's impractical and we're just not doing that, The police set the limit at 15 miles over the speed limit. If it's Los Angeles, it's 25 miles out of the speed limit. And, you drive up to 20 miles over, nobody pays any attention. And, that's a kind of, a kind of populist revolt against the laws in certain cases. That's fine if you have man-made laws serving man-made purposes, and people sort of agree in their judgment that it's a little extreme, it's not practical, and as you point out, even the police are quite understand that you don't start pulling people over under those conditions. But that's not going to work for a divine system. Unless there is built into the divine system some rule at some point which says it's open to your discretion, and there are cases like that where it is open to discretion, you won't have that kind of flexibility. Then it'll just be rebellion against the system, which would not be appropriate. An interesting observation. Yeah?
Rabbi, how do we make a Sanhedrin? How do we get a new
one? Okay. This is a very important point. Moses was originally responsible for the legal matters of the whole nation. It became too difficult. His father-in-law suggested that there be others to help him. And God agreed, and they made a Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin was made by people, each of whom Moses certified. The process is called smicha, which literally means laying on of hands. Anyone who has received that certification can certify others. And so it went for about 1,600 years. From generation to generation, people certifying their students, those whom they felt were worthy of it, or who were needed to serve this function. Half of the authorities in the Talmud did not have certification because this was a social and functional matter. We need people to be judges for the community. Not every scholar has to be a judge. So they certified those who were needed to do so. That certification is a necessary condition for being in Sanhedrin. Without that, you can't have it. And that's lapsed about 1,600 years ago. The Roman persecutions, as God allowed them to take effect, interrupted the transmission of ordination, and it lapsed. Now, there is a statement in Maimonides' Code, which is somewhat ambiguous, and one authority claimed that according to Maimonides' Code, if in the land of Israel all the rabbis would get together and agree that someone should have ordination, they could reinstitute ordination. Of course, as you can imagine, that's a very safe statement because the rabbis will never agree, right? Okay, so what happened was, 500 years ago in Tzfas, there was a movement to reinstitute ordination. And they chose one of the most outstanding scholars, and all the rabbis in Tzfas agreed that he should have ordination. The rabbis in Jerusalem did not agree, and even this one reading of the Rambam required that everybody in Israel agree, and they didn't, and that's where it died. And since then, no one has even attempted it. Now, you'll ask, if that's so, how will we ever have a Sanhedrin again? The answer is this. Elijah the prophet was ordained. He had certification. And the Tanakh says explicitly, he didn't die. He went to heaven alive. And the Talmud says that Elijah will precede the coming of the Messiah. So he will be able to reinstitute ordination, and that way, recreate a Sanhedrin. Short of that, we can't do it. Yeah?
Another example, with the piercings, is that also similar, with men getting piercings? Because is the fundamental reason why men are not allowed to have piercings is because of the Begadisha?
So now we're talking about the details of a particular law, and I'm going to tell you again, I don't know. I know that, I don't know. That's I'm not familiar with that. I know that if undertaking any kind of mutilation, self-mutilation, is forbidden. Now, are piercings mutilation? Might depend on your aesthetics. No, I'm joking. It's not, nothing to do with aesthetics. I really don't know. I don't know the details of that law. Yeah.
So if there's a rabbinic consensus, say, after the Sanhedrin, some practice can become obligatory, for example, like you said, drinking white wine, but now we don't do that anymore. Presumably, there's a new consensus because nobody suspects us. Well, at least we're not suspected in every region of the world anymore of committing blood libels. But how does that new consensus start off? I mean, I presume just one day somebody poured some red wine, people started to use it more. There was surely not a meeting of rabbis that got together to say, okay, now we'll do this. And I suspect that we'll...
No, the new consensus is arrived at by discussion. It isn't as if everybody operates in a vacuum. The rabbinical authorities have contact with one another. They have communication with one another. At a certain point, people say, look, should we continue this? Do we have to continue this? Can we be more lax about this? And a new consensus is arrived at by discussion, not by an individual doing it on his own. If he would do it on his own, then of course he'd be violating the consensus. He wouldn't be able to do that.
So in this case, they did appeal to the rabbis and it was allowed.
I would say implicitly, the rabbis themselves certified red wine for Pesach, and it was clear that they understood it was relaxed. Yeah.
Is it just consensus among the community, like the Sephardic community and the Ashkenazi community, are clearly separate?
Absolutely. No, this is a consensus for a region or for a particular legal group, a group that subscribes to a common body of laws. It doesn't have to be a consensus for the entire Jewish people.
Right.
That's why I gave examples that applied only to Europe. Yeah. And
obviously, Hasidic versus non-Hasidic have different laws and stuff. Exactly similar, or just like
okay. It's a good question. How far? When do you get into the gray area? How big is the community, and how big must the consensus be? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
Rabbinic laws that if we observe today, then we won't only not be observing the rabbinic principles behind them, but we'll be going against them. Like the example I'm thinking about is on Shabbos we don't use like electricity, like say for elevators, because like you're creating a circuit which is like building, and also you'll be creating a spark in the electricity which is like making a fire. But the principle behind that is that we shouldn't do a malacha, which is like we shouldn't do a malacha, or we don't want to do any acts of work on Shabbos. Yet there are lots of people who like who wouldn't be able to rest on. It's much harder for them to rest on Shabbos. Not only that, they're going to have to do much more work on Shabbos if they don't use such conveniences.
Okay, you're opening up a very large subject. First of all, the verses in the Torah which tell you what you're forbidden to do on Shabbos say nothing about work. They say nothing about work. You're thinking of climbing 16 flights of stairs, which is a lot of work. They say nothing about work. They say you're not supposed to do malacha. Climbing 16 flights of stairs in terms of malacha is permitted, and striking a match is forbidden. Malacha is not work. Nothing to do with sweat, aching muscles, needing a rest. Malacha has nothing to do with work. It's an entirely different concept. Roughly, malacha means a deliberate, skillful, creative physical change. Deliberate, skillful, creative physical change. Striking a match definitely fits that definition. And climbing 16 flights of stairs does not fit that condition. So to say that they don't use the elevator, they have to do lots more work. They may have to work, but it has nothing to do with malacha. Okay, that's a fundamental concept. And I must tell you, it's very painful to me that the translations all write work. And for the English reader, it is simply a terrible obstacle that he has to look at a statement that you shouldn't do work and have to figure out what the meaning is. The meaning has nothing to do with work. All right, let that suffice for now. We're going around there. Okay.
I hear a lot of statements today from like Rabbi Yashiv, like banning certain books or like banning TV. Like, how binding are the statements of the rabbis nowadays?
See, that I think is well. Talk about TV. I heard once a beautiful drasha at an Aguda convention by Rav Chaim Keller of Chicago. I'll spare you the whole drasha, but the bottom line he said was this: you eat tuna fish, you want to have extra on your tuna fish, right? You want to have a rabbinical certification. Who knows, they didn't throw swordfish in there, right? You eat meat, you want it certified, you want to make sure that it was slaughtered correctly, that they didn't stick in some horse meat, right? I tell you, he said, the television is of equal controversy. It's a controversial issue. And all I would tell you is, go to your local rabbinical decisor and ask. Like you ask everything else. You don't believe in flying blind in anything. At least you shouldn't. If you're a responsible person, you don't fly blind. Don't fly blind in this. I could tell you, as an educator, that television is a disaster. The average attention span has dropped so drastically over the last 30 years. One reason is because when you're watching television, the average time that a picture is on the screen is about 1.25 seconds, and you can't focus. You're just not able to focus. Imagine looking at a picture of someone giving a lecture on a television screen, and you just see his picture for an hour. You wouldn't be able to do it. It would drive you nuts because you're used to that constant change of stimulation, which makes it very difficult for you to focus. But let alone that, and the drastically widespread misinformation. If you watch, the CNN, you're lost. You're absolutely lost. You're off in a fantasy world of misinformation, especially about the Middle East. It's just let's just say that it's an issue that will affect your spirituality one way or another. And like every other thing in life, you want to make sure that it will have a positive effect, or at least not a deleterious effect. Go to whoever helps you make this determination of what the Torah wants and ask. Right? And the same thing is true with books. I'll just give you one little insight, then I'm going to drop this topic. What's worse, do you think? Foreign philosophy or foreign novels? Novels are much worse. They're much worse. Because when you read philosophy, the author's presenting an argument. He's trying to convince you of something, and you know that. So you're, at least to some extent, on guard. Here's his argument. Does it answer? Doesn't answer. You know, does it make sense? Can I think of counterexamples? Because he's trying to persuade you. In a novel, you just identify. You're sucked into the story, and you identify with the characters, and you come out believing in their philosophy, without ever having thought. Maybe it's a mistake. Maybe he's distorting the facts. Maybe it's very hard to maintain your critical attitude towards it. So literature has a way of sucking you in and turning off your ability of criticism and then implanting in you ideas which otherwise you might not accept. It's all quite sensitive and delicate. I believe that the danger of studying philosophy is in studying it superficially. I was a professional philosopher, and I can tell you that for every question in philosophy, there are 5 answers, and on every answer, there are 10 objections. It's a mess. Nobody knows anything from one extreme to another. There's no consensus on anything. The danger is in taking 2 courses, and in each course, the professor has an agenda, and he tells you, read these and these sources, 0.1% of the sources, and these will tell you what the truth is when what he's doing is presenting a very controversial position. When I went to graduate school in the 60s, you talk about the soul, they would laugh you out of the room. It's a non-subject, a non-option, absolutely impossible, belongs to religious superstition. Today, some of the world's greatest philosophers hold that a viable option is a non-physical thing that carries experience, interacting with the body. So says David Chalmers. So does Peter Unger, who just now published a book, 640 pages with Oxford University Press, defending what's called substance dualism. There are 2 different substances. One is physical and one is non-physical, and the other, they interact with one another. And these are recognized philosophers. What was once a non-position today has become a viable position. It happens to be our position. So the danger of philosophy is learning it superficially. If you really learn it thoroughly, then you end up totally confused. At least you don't pretend you know something and can refute somebody else's position. Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's a, I think it's a more of a public position. It's always probably been a private position, the knowledge of the soul and everything.
Yeah, but not in philosophy. Not in philosophy. Charles Taylor wrote a book about the impossibility of causal interaction. That became the refutation. It is a soul, but physical and non-physical can't interact. End of story. But that's become utterly unconvincing, and there are other reasons which people now promote as much more important, and all of a sudden became acceptable in terms of the current fashions. Yeah.
Today I'm assuming that there's a consensus that Hasidut is okay, we can marry Hasidim, attend the festivals and so on, but at the time of the Vilna Gaon, I don't think there was that consensus, at least within a certain community. It wasn't permitted. So was it indeed a sin? Would it have indeed been a sin for somebody from Vilna, or perhaps somebody from a Mitnaget background, say the Maggid of Mizrich, to follow the Baal Shem Tov, to become Hasidic then?
Okay, look, you have asked your question well, but I want to point out to the others who may know a little bit less than you that how careful you were with your terminology. You started talking about consensus. Halfway through, you dropped consensus, because you know very well that there wasn't such a consensus. And the first statement you made, there was no consensus. So then, really, your whole point could have been put without mentioning consensus altogether. It's a little bit misleading to put consensus in. The Hasidic movement attracted a certain amount of opposition, and the Vilna Gaon led the opposition, and he issued a ban. Was it on all Hasidim or only a selected group? There are different traditions historically as to what it exactly entailed. His own chief disciple, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, didn't sign the ban. His own chief disciple did not sign the ban. I mean, So he made a ban, and some people followed him. It was not a consensus by any means, but there were those who held against it. Now, everything in Jewish law is subject to controversy. Even, is this position heresy or isn't it heresy? Is this chicken kosher or treif? Is 6 p.m. Shabbos or not Shabbos? Everything is open to discussion, and everything is open to disagreement. And you can have disagreements about heresy. Maimonides and the Ravid had a disagreement about a certain position. Is it heresy or isn't it heresy? It's nothing new. It's a legal system, can be open to controversy. Here, a certain group agreed that the Hasidic movement belonged outside the norms of Judaism, and of course, others disagreed. So, if you accept a certain person as your Das Torah, your Torah guide in terms of your legal and customary practices, and he says that you shouldn't interact with Hasidim, then you shouldn't do that. But nothing binds you to a particular guide or to a particular community. This is very important. Very few people know this, and I will mention this and I'm going to end. A person born into a family that family is a member of a community and has certain customs and certain legal positions in controversies which apply to that group. The child is not required to remain a member of that group. He can shift to another group if he pleases. In the Talmud, it's discussed in the following conditions. Person lives in one city, moves to another city. Typically, in those days, each city was organized around a particular community with a particular legal head, and therefore it had uniform legal positions and customs. If you moved to another city, you changed your behavior. You changed your practice to those of the new community. You don't have a variety of people, each one doing his own thing. Now, today, you don't have a city organized around a single community. What you have is, within one city, many communities. So what the law was in those times for cities now becomes a law for communities. Someone who comes to Aras HaMelech and decides, the Rav Avad Yosef Shlita, who's one of the great leaders of the generation, a great, great scholar, and his way of practicing the Torah seems to him to be the best that he could do in his life, he's free to become a follower of Rav Avadya and take on all the Sephardi customs and all the Sephardi positions in law and follow them. His parents came from Russia or Lithuania or Romania, makes absolutely no difference. If you stay here a while, you'll meet Rabbi Samet. Rabbi Samet's one of the important people in this yeshiva. He has two sons who wear shtreimels. They're real Hasidic, you know, real Hasidic. Poor Rabbi Samet, you know, there's two kids, two of his own sons. Oh, but what about me? Two of my sons are not Hasidic. Poor me, right? We are both extraordinarily proud of our sons and happy we have our sons. We love our sons dearly, and they chose not to follow our path. So that's free for everyone to do. So a person then could say, they've put a ban on the Hasidim. I can't live that way. I don't want to live that way. I'm going to move my allegiance to another group, but then he's got to do it lock, stock, and barrel. He can't pick and choose. He can move to another community and take on their entire Jewish identity, which is, let's say, not condemnatory of Hasidim. Now, today, even that group that condemned Hasidim, that condemnation has lapsed. And today, the groups intermarry and daven in each other's synagogues and eat at each other's tables, and they celebrate each other's simchas and cooperate together on social and political projects. Agudas Yisrael, which is, in this country, a political party and a worldwide religious movement, is head by the leaders of the Hasidic movement and the non-Hasidic movement together, cooperating together in all relevant religious matters. So that ban has certainly lapsed. Okay. Welcome.
Wouldn't that be what we